Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the July 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. With us this month are Phil Broadwith, Mike Brown and Patrick Walter, and they're here to talk about the shapes of electrons, explosives detecting wetsuits, and even DIY enzymes.
You give me a new reaction and I can very rapidly generate active site models which are accurate and then build proteins which contain those active sites to give a very good starting point for, say, directed evolution methods, for example.
David Baker with a way to design enzymes from scratch. He'll be with us later in the show. My name's Chris Smith and this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
What is round? In fact, we now know it's extremely round and measures less than a billionth of a millimetre across. Phil.
OK, Chris, well, obviously we can't actually see electrons, but the standard model of physics tells us that the electron should be absolutely spherical. However, if you consider some of the other more alternative theories that include other particles that are predicted to exist, that gives us a slightly sort of off-spherical, slightly ovoid shape of an electron, but we don't really know how to tell which is which because the difference between the two is way smaller than anything that we can possibly measure.
So how can scientists then get to the bottom of that to work out if an electron is truly round, therefore some of the theories are right, or if it's not round, it's an ovoid or something, and therefore other sets of theories could be right?
Well, what you need to do, Chris, is measure the electric dipole moment of the electron, which is a distribution.
Which is what?
It's the distribution of electric charge across the surface of the electron. And you can do that with some fancy jiggery-pokery with lasers using ytterbium fluoride. And that's exactly what a team led by Ed Hines at Imperial College in London has done to a degree of accuracy about 1.5 times better than anyone's ever done before, which gets just about down to the level where some of those theories would start to predict this kind of slight oval shape of the electron.
One stat I did hear that group put forward was that they've done this to within a precision of if you were to scale the electron to the size of the solar system, then they have made measurements which are sufficiently precise that they would be right within the width of a human hair at that sort of scale, which is tremendous. I mean, it's incredible. But how did they actually do the experiment?
OK, so what they've actually done is take some ytterbium fluoride molecules, prepared them with their spins, so their spins are all aligned. You whack them with the big laser and apply an electric field, and if the direction of the spin on the ytterbium fluoride changes, then that would indicate some kind of electrical dipole moment, which you can measure. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which branch of physics you prefer, the answer that they've come up is that it's still 100% spherical.
And what are the implications of that? Obviously, we can't rewrite the physics rule book right now because they didn't find that it was a funny shape. What are the implications then of what they did find?
Okay, well, not only is this a more accurate measurement, it's a slightly improved method. And what the groups are saying is that this should be the first of a series of ever-increasingly accurate measurements that we can do in the near future to get closer and closer to narrowing down where this theory breaks down.
OK, well, don't hold your breath, because I think I heard Johnny Hudson, who is one of those researchers, say it took them 10 years to actually get the result that they did. So I guess it'll be another 10 years before they can do it with anything bigger, because it was a pretty, pretty hard experiment to do, from what they tell me.
Yeah, well, we'll see how that goes, I think.
OK, well, here's something with a little bit more traction, perhaps. Scotch tape, but this is selective scotch tape, Mike. Tell us about this.
Yeah, that's right. So here we're talking about a chemical scotch tape. So we all know about sellotape or scotch tape, where you stick things together, like cardboard boxes and things. Now we're talking about sticking single-walled carbon nanotubes to a chemical scotch tape.
And how does this work? How do they make this, and why is it useful?
OK, so at the moment, single-wall nanotubes are useful in nanoelectronics because of their conductivity and things like that. But with current technologies, you basically get a mixture of metallic and semiconducting single-wall nanotubes. at the moment, and these decrease the efficiency and the use of devices that you're going to make.
Oh, I see, because you haven't got a homogeneous population that you're using.
Yeah.
So if you could get just the ones you do want and ignore the ones you don't.
Yeah. That's basically it. Yeah, you get better a better device. So Jin Zhang has led a team at Peking University, and they've been looking at how they can separate them, still keeping them intact, but separate them easily and cheaply. And what they've come up with are these chemical scotch tapes. So what they needed was a flexible tape. So they've used a flexible polymer called PDMS, and what they've realised is that you can functionalise the polymer. In this case, they've got an A tape, which is functionalised with amines, and a P tape, which is functionalised with phenyl groups. And depending on which one you stick to the nanotube sample, you can peel off different ones. So the A tape removes semiconducting single-wall nanotubes, and the P tape removes metallic single-wall nanotubes. So depending on which ones you want, you can peel off the other ones, and then you're left with a pure sample of the nanotubes you want for your device.
Is this easy to make this stuff?
Yeah, so what the authors have said is it could be used in any lab where you want to separate nanotubes, and it is pretty easy to make. All you do is functionalise your polymer substrate, and you can make these. And the good thing about these is you can separate mixtures of long and short nanotubes without the nanotubes breaking, which is the main thing. You need to have an undamaged sample to be able to take it on to make your nanoelectronic device.
And when you actually use the tape, is it literally a case of you sprinkle on the nanotubes onto the tape and then give it a shake, and what doesn't get stuck is what you want?
Well, you start with the surface with your nanotube sample on the actual surface, and then you actually apply the tape to the surface. So instead of sprinkling onto the tape, you're actually sticking it on.
But do you not miss any? Are there not any that might be on the surface that don't quite see the tape and get picked up?
Well, I think you have to make sure that the tape covers the complete sample. I mean, they're working on square samples, and they're covering the whole sample with the tape. Yeah. So as long as you don't miss some, then yeah, you're going to get a pure sample.
I suppose anything is better than the mixture you would have had to start with, that you would have had to live with.
Yeah, that's right. They're looking at scaling up this as well in the future, and making the functionality even better so that it's even tighter bound to the tape.
Tempting to speculate that they've got that one wrapped up. Thank you, Mike. I'm off to Antarctica now. Well, sort of. Here's Robert Mulvaney.
Well, you're in the cold room, or the cold laboratory at the British Antarctic Survey. As you can see here, I've got on the shelf a range of tubes. They're all full of ice cores that we've collected in Antarctica. What I do is I go to Antarctica, I spend 2 to 3 months in the field, and I drill deep into the Antarctic ice sheet and recover a core all the way through from the surface to as deep as I can get. We bring back to the lab here, where I process the ice. It then goes through to the instruments in the laboratory next door, and I measure a range of things that tell us about how the climate and the atmosphere has been evolving over many, many thousands of years.
So talk us through the science behind that then. What are you actually looking in the ice for, and how does the story of Earth's past climate get laid down in there?
What you need to know first of all is any ice that falls in the central Antarctica, or the same in Greenland, it doesn't melt. So from one year to the next, it just builds up and builds up and builds up. So when we drill down into the ice, we're drilling down a continuous record into the past. Now, what I do when I get back here, one of the first things I do is I measure the isotopic composition of the water molecules. So water is H2O. And we measure the heavy and light isotopes of oxygen, they're called oxygen 16 and oxygen 18, and the heavy and light isotopes of hydrogen, that's hydrogen and deuterium. And the ratio of the heavy and light isotopes tells us about temperature, the amount of energy that you need to lift a heavy isotope out of the ocean and transport it to the point where it falls as snow on our drilling site is related to temperature. So the warmer the climate, the more of the heavy isotope that we see.
So you can immediately get a clue as to what the temperature on Earth was like when the water that was evaporated to make that ice was first lifted out of the ocean. What about what else was going on in the atmosphere? Is that recorded in the ice too?
Yeah, well, if I take a little slice of the ice here and show it to you, you can see that these little tiny bubbles of air are trapped in the ice. Now, these are little tiny bubbles of the actual atmosphere of the past. So we're not here now measuring something that tells us about something else. So when we measure the isotopes of water, they're what we call a proxy. They tell us about something else. They tell us about temperature. But if we take the air out of these bubbles, these are the actual air that was circulating the planet in the past. So we can reconstruct things like the record of carbon dioxide and methane, the major greenhouse gases, and see how they've evolved through time.
And how far back in time can this clock go?
Traditionally, BAS tends to measure to drill fairly shallow cores, but actually fairly shallow is up to about 1,000 metres. Now, our recent 1,000-metre core on a place called Burton Island, that goes back about 150,000 years. But we've been involved in a number of other bigger programmes. Perhaps the biggest was the European Project for Ice Coring, EPICA. That went back through the ice sheet down to about 3,200 metres and brought us back 800,000 years of record. So 800,000 years. And in that 800,000 years, we could see we had eight glacial cycles. So eight times we've been in and out of an ice age through that period of time.
And what is this revealing? When you begin to analyse those bubbles and ask what is in them, what do you see?
We quite clearly see how the climate is changing, so we can see the slow progression into an ice age and then the rapid exit from an ice age into a warm period. But all through that time, we can see how closely the carbon dioxide and the methane matches the temperature, and they're very, very close indeed. But the other thing is we can see what levels of we would expect in a normal, unperturbed atmosphere. So if you like, if we go back through that last 800,000 years, then normally in an ice age, we'd expect to see somewhere around about 190 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so about 190. You know, if you go to a warm period, we'd expect to see somewhere around about 290 parts per million. So in all of the interglacials, all the warm periods up until present, it's always been about 290 parts per million. But of course, in the atmosphere today, we're close to 390 parts per million. So we're already 100 parts per million above what we'd have actually seen in the last 800,000 years. So that's what gives us some sort of belief that when we look at the changes that we're seeing in the atmosphere at the moment, they are outside the range of the natural climate and atmosphere system.
So we're adding CO2 to the equation now because we are actually liberating it into the atmosphere. So what are the indicators that this is having some kind of effect?
Well, first of all, we should be sure that what we're adding to the atmosphere is coming from the fossil fuels and not from some natural cycling of the carbon dioxide. Now, if you imagine carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's either been released into the atmosphere or absorbed back by the oceans and by the forest systems. Now, that's effectively the same carbon dioxide cycling through the system. Now, if that same carbon dioxide is cycling through the system, then it doesn't tend to change the isotopic composition of the carbon in that carbon dioxide. But what we're seeing at the moment is the carbon isotope signature in the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at the moment is starting to move away from the long-term mean, if you like, and it's starting to move more towards the carbon isotope signature of fossil fuels. So that's what gives us confidence that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is not from a natural source, it's from fossil fuels.
Can we have a look at some of these ice cores?
Yes, what we've got here, we've got quite a few on the shelf here. This one's from a place called Dyer Plateau, as you can see. It's called Dyer 90. In fact, it was drilled in 1990. What I pulled out for you there is a piece of core. It's already been processed, as you can see. We've already taken part of the edge off it. But it's about, I would say, 100 millimetres in diameter and about a metre long. This, what I'm holding up for you, is actually a piece of shallow ice. It's only 45 metres deep. You can see it's sort of like fairly porous as I hold it. If I just get another piece out that's gone deeper in the ice. You can see now, if I just take this little slice out of the core here, this has come from quite a bit deeper. But you can see it's gone from this sort of fairly white-looking porous medium to something that's much more glassy. And I think it's quite clear you can see there the air bubbles in it. Now, if I just start to warm it up with a bit of luck, what we might hear is that the bubbles starting to explode. Let's see if we can get that going.
Would that reflect the pressure
made? Yeah, this piece of ice is from about 233 metres down in the ice.
So how old's that?
This is not that old. This is only about 1,000 metres, so 1,000 years old at this site.
It is quite hard to warm things up in here. What temperature is it in this?
It's minus 25 in here, and I've just taken a piece of ice, minus 25 ice, and I'm rubbing it between my hands to melt it. I don't know if you can hear that.
I certainly can with my ears. I don't know if the microphone's picking that up, but there's a cracking noise, yeah. Definitely.
What that crackling is the ice is under pressure, so for every 10 metres down we go into the ice sheet is an extra one atmosphere of pressure, so we're 233 metres down, about 23 extra atmospheres of pressure there.
So let me ask you a few things about the practical aspects of actually going and getting this material, because it's pretty cold in this cold room. Antarctica's a lot colder than this, though, isn't it?
We're there in the summer, and a lot of the sites that we're working at during the summer are about this sort of temperature. But to be honest, it's really when the wind comes. If you've got a wind on top of the temperature, that's when it really gets cold. But, you know, we're dressed well. We're well looked after. We do all our drilling undercover, so we're not out in the open. So it is uncomfortable, but it's, you know, you get used to it.
These scientists are built of stern stuff. That was Robert Mulvaney from the British Antarctic Survey. And now, from the white stuff to silver stuff, and a history lesson. Patrick.
Well, I'm sure everyone's heard of the Great Price Revolution of the 16th and 17th century.
Actually, I haven't.
Perhaps if you haven't, then it was a period of high inflation across Western Europe. And there have been various competing theories as to why this is, and one of the most influential ones was that Spain was being flooded by silver that was coming from Mexico and mines in the Andes as well.
OK, and so how can you get to the bottom of whether that were true or not?
So metals like silver have different isotopic ratios depending on where they're mined.
Do you mean as in there are contaminants in the silver which are different isotopes, or the silver metal itself comes in different flavours or isotopes?
Right, it's not contaminants in the metal, it's different isotopes. So there's two different stable isotopes, naturally occurring isotopes of silver. This is the silver 107 and silver 109.
So how can they be used to answer this question?
As each ore has a different isotope signal, you can use mass spectrometry to distinguish between the different isotopes. So you can actually pick out which is which, and you can tell European silver, Spanish silver from silver mined in Mexico or the Andes.
Oh, ingenious. So basically, if you look at the silver that was allegedly around at the time, and it's got a Mexican hallmark to it, mm-hmm. chemically speaking, that strongly argues that it was this influx of silver from South America that was driving inflation.
Yeah.
And what did they find?
So during the price revolution of 1520 to 1650, it turns out there was very little Mexican or Andean silver actually entering Spain.
Oh, so it can't have been that was driving this big inflation then?
No, it appears that Mexican and Andean silver didn't start flooding the Spanish markets until the 1700s.
So if it wasn't the silver, what was it?
Well, there's various different theories. This was coming shortly after the Black Death that spread all across Europe and decimated the population by perhaps as much as a half. And during the quick recovery from this, as the population once again rose, demand on food increased, and as demand on food increased, prices went up. And there are various other possible factors. Spain was at war with the Netherlands. They had a lot of debt to pay off, so that this partly explains why the inflation might have increased in Spain, for instance.
Sounding highly reminiscent of the situation today, isn't it?
Indeed.
Anyway, let's look at something slightly different. Thank you for that, Patrick. Mike, tell us about this caterpillar, which crawls, and you can see it, but it's not a real caterpillar, it's a chemical.
Yeah, so on the show, we've talked a lot about molecular motors and molecular DNA walkers and things like that. But this is a polymer-based device that you can actually see walking across a surface.
Okay.
And it's a polymer that moves in response to humidity. So when it's dry, when the air is dry, in this case nitrogen is dry, it's relaxed state, so it's lying down. And when there's humidity around, then it gets up, basically. And the changes shape. So the motion of it getting up kind of moves it across the surface.
How does it get any kind of friction with the surface then?
Okay, so the surface that it's on is pretty rough and grooved. So it's like ridges. It has claws on the bottom of its feet as well. And so these kind of lock into the grooves, and that gives it its direction, really. The device is quite simple. It's a hydrogel which absorbs water, and it expands in response to rising humidity. And it's got two supports, so it's a hydrogel strip, and then on each end it has these harder polymers which are inert to humidity. So they're the feet, and as we said earlier, it stands on a rough surface. So the team at Jilin University in China have been changing the humidity of nitrogen that they pass across it from 11% to 40%. And they've been observing the changes in the polymer as it does that. And it actually moves rather like a caterpillar would, where it picks up its back and you get an arched back and then it moves forward.
Why is this useful? What's the point?
on the one hand, it's quite fun to see, you know, just a polymer that allows something to move across the surface, albeit it's moving because of the rough surface. But the team do say that, you know, you could use it as a humidity sensor. One thing that I forgot to mention earlier is that the polymer is pretty strong, and it can actually carry a load 120 times heavier than itself.
Oh, so you could use it like some kind of switch. You could actually make it do some work in the course of making these movements. So it could actually be a useful humidity detector or something capable of registering some kind of output.
Yeah, that's right. They also speculate that in the future they could create a similar device which changes in response to a chemical or heat or light as well. So there's a wide variety of ways that the research could go forward.
But not backwards at the moment.
But not backwards, because the ridges in the surface wouldn't allow it. Yeah, that's right, Chris.
You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, a way to pick up pollutants with your wetsuit. First, though, what do you do if you've got a chemical reaction you want catalysed? The answer is, you talk to this man, David Baker.
The problem is really a challenge that's posed by the almost miraculous ability of naturally occurring enzymes to catalyze reactions with very, very high efficiencies. And in principle, if we understood the mechanisms by which naturally occurring enzymes catalyze the whole vast myriad of reactions that go on in our bodies and elsewhere, we should be able to make new catalysts that catalyze reactions that are of interest to humans now that nature didn't really ever care about during evolution, so never generated catalysts for.
You make it sound very simple, but I mean, if you just take a snapshot, a catalyst, these enzymes, they're proteins, and even a very small one is made up of, say, 100 amino acids, which means that that's 20 to the power 100 possible isomers that you could make of that protein. So it's not trivial to say, well, we'll just suss out how this molecule does what it does.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's not at all trivial. Not only are there a huge number of possible sequences, but if you choose one sequence, say that you've designed that you expect will fold up to a particular structure which will have a geometry compatible with catalysis, that's just one possible structure that sequence could adopt. In an even larger sea of other possible conformations it could adopt, which wouldn't be catalytic. So we have to pick out the right sequence, and that sequence has to fold up to exactly the right structure and not to any other.
So if I did want an enzyme which did a certain chemical reaction, how would I start trying to rationally design an enzyme from scratch that could do that?
You would start by embodying your understanding of that reaction by making an ideal active site. So enzymes contain active sites, which is sort of the center where all the chemistry happens. And so you would start by drawing a model of the chemical reaction, just the small molecule transformation that you want to catalyze. And in particular, you would focus on the transition state, which is the highest energy state along the reaction pathway. And then you would position functional groups that proteins have around this transition state. So you might create a hydrogen bond on one place a protein functional group like an OH group to make a hydrogen bond on one side, put a positive charge from the protein underneath, a negative charge coming from the side, and so forth. So you would get a three-dimensional representation of an ideal active site, but at that stage there would be no whole protein scaffold holding those functional groups in the right places. And then the next step, you'd have to design a protein which connected the dots, which held all those functional groups in exactly the right places.
So it's effectively, you are saying, right, I need to know, first of all, what is the chemistry I want to achieve so that I can put the relevant groups in the right places relative to each other, which is what the active site of an enzyme is effectively doing. So you've already
exactly
got to know quite a bit about the chemistry that you want to achieve.
Yes, and you don't really know that active site would catalyze the reaction. It might just be a hypothesis. So what we generally do is come up with a number of different possible active site arrangements and do this for each one, so we get different possible arrangements of the catalytic groups for each chemistry possibility.
That doesn't sound terribly efficient, though.
Yes, well, this process is not terribly efficient right now. But you see, as you pointed out, part of what we're limited by is an understanding of the chemistry, what's important. And then the other part we're limited by is, suppose we knew the chemistry perfectly so we could make an ideal active site, then the second part becomes hard. It's also very hard. We have to create a protein scaffold which will hold all those groups in exactly the right places and maybe even allow some wiggling when the chemical transformation happens and the small molecule changes shape.
Is this something that we can achieve with big, powerful computers these days? Because trying to hold all of those possible arrangements in mind at once, that's going to be very computationally demanding. But we have got pretty good computers these days.
We have been very fortunate. Not only have we been able to get access to supercomputer time, but we also have a panel of volunteers all around the world, about 300,000 people who participate in a project called Rosetta at Home, who contribute the spare cycles on their computers to help us design new enzymes and other things like new therapeutics. But they're also helping us with some of the design through a project called Foldit, where players who play Foldit can come in and help us design enzymes. And very recently, Foldit players helped us make a real advance on the Diels-Alder catalyst, which we described last year in Science.
So do you think then that we're actually going to get to a stage pretty soon where, rather than this brute force approach, we'll actually have a number of different orientations and structures already designed which are quite good at handling certain groups of chemicals, so that you can apply those generically almost with modest tweaking to any kind of reaction you could want to try and unleash?
That's certainly the goal. Every new reaction, though, will always present challenges. And so I'm not sure if you'll be able to have a relatively small number of these ideal sites that are well understood. But we'd like to have the whole process. So you give me a new reaction, and I can very rapidly generate active site models which are accurate and then build proteins which contain those active sites to give a very good starting point for, say, directed evolution methods, for example.
Are you only playing with the amino acids that we would find in a normal cell? And I'm asking that because obviously the big synthetic biology drive now is beginning to say, well, we don't need to be constrained by the chemistry that nature does anymore. We can reprogram the genetic code in the sense that we can insert different amino acid building blocks into our proteins. So can you work like that too?
Yes, in fact, for the last year and a half, we've been doing exactly that. We've been working to make catalysts with unnatural amino acids, using the technology developed in Peter Schultz's group, where you can actually expand the genetic code.
So if someone said to you, maybe the Bill Gates Foundation or something, said, look, we'll give you a huge amount of money, choose a target that you think the world really needs right now, what would you pick?
I think I would say that what the world really needs are the methods to do this reliably, and so I would invest the resources in trying to develop the methods, because the danger is if you just went after one target, you might get there, but you might have gotten there and then found that it was no longer as relevant as you thought. If we could just make the methods better, then we could approach all problems much, much better. But I can tell you one thing that we've done recently, which is looking tremendously exciting right now, which is designing inhibitors for the flu virus. These aren't catalysts per se, but they're very closely related to catalysts. And these look like they have considerable potential for blocking, say, the pandemic strains of the flu. So I think there are some very exciting things one can do with computational design, even in its current imperfect state.
David Baker, he's at the University of Washington. And now, a substance that can be both an insulator, a conductor, and even a superconductor. Although, to get all of those effects, you do need to cool it down a bit. Well, quite a lot, actually. Phil?
Yes, so we've got a material which starts as a complete insulator, goes through a semiconducting, then a metallic, and then finally a superconducting phase, and neither of the materials that it's made from is actually superconducting on its own.
What temperature does this happen at?
OK, you do have to get pretty cold. We're down to 5/1000ths of a Kelvin above absolute zero.
Wow, OK, so that's pretty cold. Well, what are the substances that are used to make it?
We're talking about potassium tantalum oxide, that's the solid, and if we're going to continue the sandwich analogy, that you could think of as the bread. And then on top of that, you've got a liquid, an ionic liquid, made from diethyl maleic acid ester cations and boron tetrafluoride anions. And that sort of sits on the top. Admittedly, at this very cold temperatures that we're talking about, that does freeze, but it still maintains the interesting interface properties which allows it to be superconducting.
Indeed. So is the idea that we learn how this material does this and has these interesting chemistries so that you can then produce an equivalent but which doesn't require 0.005 of a degree above absolute zero to work?
Yes, that's right. What Masahashi Kawasaki at Tohoku University in Japan is saying is that this kind of electrostatic doping, because that's what's going on, essentially the electrons at the interface of the two materials, when you apply a slight voltage, become very mobile as it gets colder and colder and colder and eventually become superconducting. So this is, rather than mixing two different materials together to get a new material by what's called chemical doping, we're just doping the electrons, if you like. So this electrostatic doping could open the way to whole families of new superconducting materials, which hopefully would work at slightly higher temperatures.
Yeah, let's hope so, because that is really quite unassailably cold, isn't it? Now, Patrick, talking about electrons and things swimming around, stick with the swimming analogy and tell us about these sensors. Apparently, they can go in wetsuits, even.
Yes, that's right. Surfer dudes have now got a new best friend with a wetsuit that can pick up organic contaminants like phenols in the water, so they know when to get out and to swim away as fast as they can, I suppose.
Well, I was going to say, there's not a lot you can do about it if you're riding a wave at the time. But how much can it pick up? How sensitive is the technique then?
Right, well, these sensors have been produced on wetsuits to detect a number of different things. So for phenols, for instance, they can pick it up at 0.25 micromolar. But for TNT, the explosive, that is...
On the off chance you stumble into a minefield clad in your wetsuit.
I think so. I think they're thinking naval applications here as well. They can detect TNT at 42 parts per billion, so it's a lot more sensitive for that.
Indeed. And how does it work, then?
Well, the sensor consists of a number of... inks. So you have a silver chloride based ink, and then layered on top of that is two carbon based electrode inks. For the phenols, mixed in with the inks is also a tyrosinase. This is an enzyme which can break down the phenols into quinones, another molecule.
Okay, so what you'd print onto the surface?
So you can print directly onto the neoprene surface of the wetsuit.
Yeah.
And then when the tyrosinase is exposed to a phenol, it converts into the quinone, and the change in the current that is passing through, that's provided by the battery that is integral to the whole sensor, picks this up, and the LED on the wetsuit changes from green to red, indicating danger in this instance.
You better hope it doesn't short out. So it's obviously proof of principle at this stage, and you could presumably scale this in a number of different directions, because it's a way of detecting all kinds of different chemical species using things you can just print, I presume, fairly simply onto a material surface.
Yeah, it's fairly simple flat-screen printing, and you can do it on all sorts of things. I mean, one of the most important things is that it's flexible. So it works on wetsuits, it could work on any kind of protective clothing, so people could be detecting things like explosives, been mentioned. They've also worked with heavy metals, so it could be in toxic, highly contaminated environments.
And rock concerts.
Mm.
That kind of thing.
Glastonbury.
Phil, don't go away. I see you smirking there, because now, talking of making light of the situation and telling rather rubbish jokes, that's my job. What's this month's trivia?
Well, the question this month is, how many elements are there on the periodic table?
Well, we talked, Victoria Gill talked about anunbium when it was discovered and announced, that being element 112, now called copernicium. So I'd say 112.
Well, up until a couple of weeks ago, you'd have been right, Chris.
But now
unfortunately,
wrong.
Not now.
How many is it then?
Well, at the beginning of June, the working group from IUPAC finally made their decision about elements 113, 14, 15, 16 and 18.
Oh, blimey. So buses come three at a time. Elements come 13, 14, 15, 16, 18, 8, 5 at a time?
Well, not quite, because only 114 and 116 passed the test. Only they had enough evidence for the IUPAC group to say, yes, actually, we can definitely say you've found a new element and you get to name it.
Oh, so people were submitting evidence for the existence of these elements for a while. But IUPAC then apply some criteria and say some fulfil those criteria and can be added to the periodic table.
Yes, that's right, Chris. And in this case... the people who have gained the crown, if you like, and won priority for the discovery is a group from Dubna in Russia collaborating with a group from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in California in the States.
How do they make these new elements then?
Well, they make them by smashing smaller elements together in the hope that they will at some point fuse and make bigger nuclei. In this case, for element 114, we're talking about uranium being smashed with calcium ions. And for element 116, you need a slightly heavier. So californium smashed with calcium.
When copernicium was announced, people laughed because they said it hangs around for a matter of milliseconds. Are these new ones any longer lived?
Well, copernicium is actually pretty long lived compared to these guys. We're talking 26 milliseconds for element 116 and a slightly longer half a second for element 114. Copernicium, the longest lived isotopes of copernicium can last up to 7.5 seconds.
Gosh, as long as that. What about naming it though? Because that also took a really long time. That's why this ununbium 112 ununbium name came along. Have they got any names for these?
Well, obviously the IUPAC placeholder names of ununquadium and ununhexium will still be around until the groups involved can agree a name that's also agreeable to IUPAC. But the Russian group involved have put forward their proposals for the name. They're proposing fluorovium for element 114 after Georgi Flerov, the Russian scientist, and also muscovium after the region
Moscovich, the rather rubbish Russian cars.
No, actually after the Muscovy region around Moscow where Dubna is.
I bet these two Russian names for these two elements have gone down a storm with the Americans.
Well, there's not been very much word from the Americans yet in the press, so we'll
just
have to just see.
Just a nuclear missile going the other way, probably.
Well, I'm making no comment.
And on Phil's silent note, that's it for this month. Thanks to our contributors, Phil Broadwith, Patrick Walter and Mike Brown, and our guests, Robert Mulvaney and David Baker. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.